I'm Christopher Lydon with the reporter-historian Stephen Kinzer, considering American power gains in the world, then and now. First question is why the secret world war of the Dulles brothers, Foster and Allen Dulles, at the pinnacle of U.S. diplomacy and spycraft in the 1950s, why their power persisted 50 years after their deaths. Second question is just how deeply the Dulles' ways of waging world dominance are coming apart even as we speak. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Steve Kinzer, there's more than just history in your new book, The Brothers. It's all about the global muscle of John Foster and Allen Dulles. But for me, the story is entangled today with this incredibly loaded 50-year marker after John F. Kennedy's assassination. The institutional weight of those Dulles brothers bore mightily on JFK's life, maybe on his death, but certainly on his checkered record in Vietnam, in Cuba, in Africa, and with the superpower Russia. And the whole story bears, ironically, and still very heavily, I think, on whatever it is that's unfolding in this strange age of Obama. In 2013, this opening to Iran, the non-attack on Syria, this flood of unsavory secrets about U.S. security games coming out of these telltale, we don't know what, heroes or villains, Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. So there are dots to connect here. But start with the Dulles brothers themselves, this duo that had the corporate power, the covert CIA power, and the military power to shake the world. And they used it. Just remind us of these guys that most people have forgotten.
It's truly remarkable that the Dulles brothers, who were such huge figures in their time, have been more or less forgotten today. These people had the power to make and break governments, and they did. But now, we've more or less airbrushed them out of our history. It's the purpose of my book to try to bring them back to life and through their stories tell a larger story. So my book is a biography of these extraordinary brothers, but it's something more than that. I'm trying to use the framework of biography to ask this larger question: why does the United States behave the way that it does in the world? Why is it that whenever there's some conflict or confrontation in Belize or Bangladesh or Burundi or Bolivia or Bhutan, the United States has to decide, what are we going to do? Who do we want to push out? Who do we need to put in? What kind of a regime do we want for that country? Why is it that we can't lean back and say, well, I guess that problem in Bolivia is something the Bolivians are just going to have to work out? So the Dulles brothers' story is also the story of America. The forces that shaped them shaped our country, not just during the 1950s, but for years to come. One of the central points I try to make is that our fundamental understanding of the 1950s is wrong. We think of the 1950s as a time of peace, tense peace, but actually that wasn't true. We now know, with the revelations from classified documents and memoirs and histories, that the United States, and particularly the Dulles brothers, were waging a constant world war during the 1950s. We didn't see this because it was being fought secretly, or in places where we did see it, for example, the civil war in Indonesia in the mid-50s, we thought this was just a domestic problem in the country involved. We didn't know that we were involved in promoting all this. So when you tie all of these together, you see the dimensions of this war. The theater shifted. That's another reason why I think we didn't notice it. It started in Iran, then it was Guatemala, Vietnam, Indonesia, Cuba, the Congo, Egypt, country after country. But that war was a series of covert and not-so-covert interventions for which we're still paying the price.
You remind us of that line we all love to quote from John Quincy Adams saying, the United States goes not in search of monsters to destroy, but that's what the 50s were about. And just remind us of some of those villains, those countries, those crises that in certain sense came out of the Dulles brothers' minds.
The Dulles brothers' war started with two interventions in the early 1950s, soon after they came to office. That was in Guatemala and Iran. I think these two are tied together by one particular factor. The Dulles brothers, of course, spent decades as corporate lawyers for this remarkable law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. This firm had a specialty of pushing around small countries to force them to accept American corporations and allow those corporations to operate freely. One client of the Dulles brothers was something called the Schroeder Bank, which was a big international bank, and Alan Dulles was actually on the board of the Schroeder Bank. Now, the Schroeder Bank was the financial agent for the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which owned the oil industry in Iran. In 1951, the democratically elected government of Iran nationalized its oil industry. So Alan Dulles had to go back to his friends at the Schroeder Bank and say something like, you hired us to protect your interests in Iran, and we failed. You don't have your oil company there anymore. We lost it. And then shortly thereafter, we had a similar operation in Guatemala. So the Guatemalan government, again, with the vote of its Congress, adopted a land reform program. That land reform program affected the interests of United Fruit, which was another big Sullivan and Cromwell client who both Dulles brothers represented, and both brothers held large blocks of United Fruit stock. There was nothing they could do about the land reform program in Guatemala, and they had to go back to United Fruit and say, we failed you. We couldn't protect your interests in Guatemala. Now, the Dulles brothers were not used to failing, and they didn't like having to do this. They never forgot that Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran and President Arbenz in Guatemala had deeply wounded clients of their firm and themselves. So they couldn't do anything about it while they were private lawyers, but they carried this grudge with them. And in 1953, when John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State and Alan Dulles became Director of the CIA, they immediately set out against these two. And within a year and a half after they took office, both were gone. Mossadegh was gone in Iran, Arbenz was gone in Guatemala, and it wasn't just two leaders who were gone. Those two countries were plunged into periods of terror and violence from which they still have not recovered. So those were the first two monsters that the Dulles brothers went abroad to slay.
Steve, I still remember, and I'm quoting it all the time, your book on the All the Shah's Men about the overthrow of the Mossadegh government in Iran. It began with the same Brits, including Churchill, in effect, telling the Truman administration, look, they've taken our oil away, our oil, and you got to help us get it back. And Truman and Dean Acheson said, forget it. That colonial era is over. It's their oil and tough luck. And we're not going to intervene for you. Almost as soon as Eisenhower unpacked his bags in the White House, the Dulles brothers started implementing this plan. I mean, it's astonishing to read, and I don't think it's secret news, really, but the combination of corporate power, again, secret CIA power, and the backup military power. The United States government under Eisenhower sent in what Kim Roosevelt with vast piles of $100 bills and basically stirred up the street revolution that scared Mossadegh out of government, put the Shah in. I mean, how do we explain that they got away with it in broad daylight?
The Dulles brothers were products of some important forces that also shaped our national psyche and shaped the United States, which is why I say that they're us and we're them. One force is the one that we just touched on, and that is corporate power. So the Dulles brothers spent decades trying to pressure small countries to do what American corporations wanted. And they began to see the interests of the United States and the interests of American corporations as identical. This is the mindset they took with them into office. So any government that tried to regulate, tax, or otherwise bother an American corporation became our enemy. And once they came into power, they were able to lash out against those enemies. But there's another force that I think was equally powerful in shaping the Dulles brothers' approach to the world. They grew up in a very religious household. The father was a Presbyterian minister. The grandfather was a minister. The uncles were ministers. And many of the ancestors were also missionaries. They grew up in this idea of missionary Calvinism. And what they absorbed from their deeply religious upbringing was a sense, as is taught by Calvinism, that first of all, the world is divided between the good and the evil, the right and the wrong. Other cultures don't learn this. Many other cultures learn that all of us are composed of good and evil impulses, and these come out in different proportions according to different situations. They didn't believe this. They believed that there's absolute good and absolute evil. And the other piece of this is that good people, the Christians, are not allowed to sit home and just hope that good triumphs over evil and that the Christian idea will remain triumphant in the world, you have to go out and do it. You can't just hope. You have to go out and convert the heathens and the unconverted. It's a very small step from believing that about religion to believing the same idea about politics. You begin to think there are some regimes and governments in the world that embody good, and there are others that embody evil. Therefore, it is required of the good, and that's us, to go out in the world and crush the leaders and governments and regimes that are evil. So I think those two forces, missionary Calvinism and corporate power, led them to go off onto these adventures and to believe that they were doing something hugely positive.
Steve Kinzer, you quote Foster Dulles in his own private papers in an interview probably later in life, but he said, "For us, there are two kinds of people, those who are Christians and support free enterprise, and then there are the others."
This was really the way that Foster Dulles justified his interventions. We can ask ourselves, if you are promoting the idea of the United States in the world, how do you justify going to a country like Iran or Guatemala, destroying a democratic government, and imposing a dictatorship in its place? The Dulles brothers came up with a peculiar way to justify this, and it was their own definition of what constitutes freedom and democracy. First of all, they believed a country could only be democratic if its leaders were on good terms with local religious leaders, especially Christian leaders. In Guatemala, for example, President Arbenz was on bad terms with the archbishop, who was a great admirer of Francisco Franco and believed that land reform was, in his words, totally communistic. So that was one mark against him. And the other definition that the Dulles brothers used for whether a country was free or not is, does this country allow foreign corporations to invest freely and work freely here? In other words, do they respect what he would call commerce and free trade? Now, in Iran and Guatemala, those governments tried to restrict the activities of foreign corporations. That made them evil governments. And the dictatorships that followed after the collapse of democracy in both Iran and Guatemala did invite all foreign corporations into their countries and embrace them and allow them to do what they wanted. So that's how the Dulles brothers were able to see these transformations from democratic regimes to dictatorships as actual triumphs for freedom.
Steve, I remember the Dulles brothers in the 1950s. I knew John Foster Dulles mainly by the Herblock cartoons that made relentless fun of him, this kind of very uptight, righteous, white guy running around the world, making pacts with everybody, CETO and beyond NATO, CENTO, all of this kind of trying to tie up the world. Herblock thought it was ridiculous. William O. Douglas, the Supreme Court Justice in your book, also found it just noxious. He said, I'm not sure I want to go to heaven for fear that John Foster Dulles will be up there, looking down his nose at us. How did it become so sort of consensual and uncontroversial that American foreign policy became John Foster Dulles?
This was the only time in history that brothers controlled the overt and the covert sides of American foreign policy. It was a recipe for trouble because they never had to consult anyone else. There was never a necessity for a meeting between the State Department experts and the CIA experts on country X to decide whether an intervention was a good idea or not. Just a wink and a nod between the two brothers was enough, and then a covert operation would be launched on some huge scale halfway around the world.
And also premises would be laid down. Ho Chi Minh, for example, in Vietnam, our worst imaginable enemy. But Ho Chi Minh had been counting on Franklin Roosevelt's assurance that after World War II, Roosevelt would get the French out of Indochina. It could have been a very sympathetic nationalist cause if somehow the Dulles brothers hadn't been running the American mind as well as the foreign policy.
The Vietnam debacle might be the darkest black mark against John Foster Dulles. He is more responsible for American involvement in Vietnam than any single individual. It all goes back to 1954, when there was a conference in Geneva at which world leaders met to decide, what are we going to do about Vietnam? At this point, the French had just lost their big battle at Dien Bien Phu, and they were finished. They announced that very reluctantly they had concluded, Ho Chi Minh is too popular, he's too powerful, he can't be defeated, and we're just going to have to throw in the towel and move on to the next project. Winston Churchill also recommended the same course. He had this line, "The loss of the fortress must be faced." In other words, grow up and realize we lost the war, and let's just move on. But John Foster Dulles refused to accept this premise. He left the Geneva Conference in the middle. It's the only time in history that an American Secretary of State has walked out of a big international conference before it ended. And the reason he left was that he saw what the conference was about to do, which is accept that Ho Chi Minh would take over a part of Indochina. Now, think about it. As Foster Dulles drove out to the airport and flew home, he resolved the United States is going to fill the vacuum. We are going to go fight Ho Chi Minh. If that one guy had not made that one decision on that one day, we might have been able to avoid the entire American involvement in Vietnam. And it's difficult to wrap your mind around how different America and the world might be under that circumstance.
I want to challenge the two brothers' notion. There were also McGeorge Bundy and Bill Bundy. McGeorge in the policy office of the Kennedy administration, Bill Bundy long high in Allen and Dulles' own CIA. That was another brother act. But go back to these Dulles brothers themselves. I mean, one a kind of Puritan, one a sort of libertine. But between them, how did it work? How did they work with each other?
You have to understand, first of all, that they grew up very intimately. They came from an extraordinarily elite family. The father was only a clergyman, so not a plutocrat, but they were growing up in a town, Watertown, New York, on the shores of Lake Ontario, that was kind of a playground for the New York rich. Their grandfather had been Secretary of State. Their uncle was Secretary of State. When they were 10 and 12 years old, they were sitting at dinners at their grandfather's house on DuPont Circle in Washington. And the other dinner guests were people like Andrew Carnegie, Woodrow Wilson, William Howard Taft, Grover Cleveland, ambassadors, cabinet secretaries. So they grew up learning not just the ideas of the ruling elite, but their manners and their style. In fact, Allen Dulles, who went on to be the head of the CIA, had a very interesting response to these dinners. After dinner was over, the two boys would go up to bed, and Allen, before going to bed, would take out his notebook and write to himself an intelligence report of what he had just seen. He would list all the people that attended, what they said, and then what his own opinion was about what they really meant. So here's a kid that isn't even in his teens, future head of the CIA, which does not even exist then, already showing this bent towards intelligence. Now, as they grew older, they came to view the world in exactly the same way. Politically and ideologically, they were twins. But their personalities were polar opposites. Maybe you would need a psychologist to explain this. But the reality was, John Foster Dulles became a self-righteous, arrogant, prudish preacher who was always very stern, moralistic, distant. I read somewhere, even his friends didn't like him. He was socially awkward and had a whole series of unpleasant habits and never out on the social scene. He would like to sit at home with his wife while she knitted and he read a detective story. Allen Dulles, the younger brother, was the exact opposite. He was a sparkling personality. He loved good wine and fine food, the company of rich people. He was like a character out of The Great Gatsby with his button loafers and his beautiful blazers, endless supply of stories. He was a compulsive adulterer who had 100 mistresses. He was always going from one party to another in Georgetown. And I think this was important when he became head of the CIA for this reason. Allen Dulles was not just the head of the invisible government. He was also the ambassador of the invisible government to the visible government. I think it led a lot of people in Washington to think, we don't really know what the CIA is doing, and of course it has the potential to do a lot of bad things, but if it's being run by such a wonderful guy like Allen, how bad can it be?
And then at the very tail end of the Eisenhower administration, there's Cuba and there's the Congo. Both big stories with very, very long shadows even to this day. Sketch the main lines of Cuba and Castro and then the Congo and Patrice Lumumba. To what degree do those fit your manufactured monster model?
The two operations at the end of the Dulles era, the one against Fidel Castro in Cuba and the one against Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, have a number of interesting aspects in common. One of the most interesting ones is that President Eisenhower, who fervently supported covert action, although nobody understood that at the time, of course, personally, although slightly indirectly, ordered not just those operations in Cuba and the Congo, but the assassination of those two leaders. So we have, in the space of one summer, Eisenhower ordering two assassinations, and as far as we know, no president has ever done that before. Now, the way that Alan Dulles electrified Eisenhower and the National Security Council to galvanize them into action in the Congo was to say to them, Patrice Lumumba is going to become the African Castro. In this sense, we put together these two great demons. So Castro had emerged in a country where almost all of the biggest legal American businesses were represented by the Dulles brothers. They had deep, deep ties to Cuba. John Foster Dulles had been involved in arranging the landing of U.S. troops in Cuba in 1917 when he was just a minor associate at Sullivan and Cromwell. There was trouble in Cuba. American corporations were threatened because the Liberal Party, which wanted to restrict the power of American corporations, had won an election. In order to be sure that that election result was not respected, those corporations that were afraid of this election came to Sullivan and Cromwell, their law firm. Sullivan and Cromwell gave the job to John Foster Dulles. He got on the train to Washington. He met the Secretary of State, who he knew as Uncle Bert. The rest of the world knew him as Secretary of State Robert Lansing. He told Uncle Bert, we need to send two warships full of Marines to Cuba. The next day, those warships were sent. 6,000 Marines debarked. They put down the liberal rebellion and remained occupying Cuba for years. So the fact that a leader had come to power in Cuba and was not only not interested in cooperating with American companies, but wanted to expel them, rang terrible bells for the Dulles brothers that went back half a century. And they were fervently eager to crush him and really believed that they could do it. They had this fantasy that any leader who was critical of the United States or anti-American had to be very unpopular with his own people. It could never be in their mindset that these guys could be popular. So Castro was the last great target in our hemisphere who we went after during the Dulles era. And then came Patrice Lumumba. Lumumba emerged after the Congo became independent in 1960. He was elected prime minister, but he tried to do something that the Dulles brothers hated, and that was embrace the ideology of neutralism. He didn't want to be involved in the Cold War. This was the same sin that Arbenz in Guatemala had committed, and Mossadegh in Iran, and Sukarno in Indonesia, and Nasser in Egypt, and Nehru in India. John Foster Dulles actually used the word immoral to describe neutralism. He thought it was in some ways worse than Bolshevism. To his mind, all these neutralist and nationalist leaders were just tools of the Kremlin. He thought that the Soviets had figured out there were certain countries in the world that they couldn't take over right away, so they should get one of their agents to take over these countries, possibly through some election, and then pose as neutralists. And this would be just the bridge to those countries falling to communism. So they saw neutralist leaders as great enemies, and Lumumba they greatly feared, because not only was he emerging in a hugely powerful and potentially very rich country, but he had the potential to influence all of Africa. He was hugely popular, and he had only been in power a matter of weeks before Alan Dulles began an intense operation in cooperation with the Belgians, the old colonial power, and that ended after only a period of months with Prime Minister Lumumba not only overthrown, but assassinated.
Patrice Lumumba, seen then and ever after as the most charismatic, sort of magical post-colonial leader that Africa ever produced, and a figure of huge hope, a figure for the whole continent, and a man who is terribly missed today. I mean, in a free country here with a free media, why did that characterization of Patrice Lumumba prevail?
When Lumumba came to New York, to the United Nations, he gave a number of press conferences, and at one of them he was asked about whether he feared for his life. And he said, if I am killed, it will be because a foreigner has paid a Congolese. And that is exactly what happened. Now, you ask a very good question. Why is it that people in the United States were not more outraged about this and not more active? I think it was because of two reasons. Number one, we didn't know what was happening. You mentioned, for example, that William O. Douglas, the Supreme Court Justice, was a great friend and admirer of Mohammad Mossadegh, the leader who the Dulles brothers overthrew in Iran. Why then would not Justice Douglas have spoken out against this operation and protested it and told the American people this is a bad idea? We should not be trying to overthrow Mossadegh. I think the answer is simple. He had no idea that the plot was even underway. So it was very difficult for us to know these things. But I think there's another reason. It's not just the ignorance of our individuals that is an accident. The press played a big role during the 1950s in keeping these operations secret. And Alan Dulles was very influential in making sure this happened. Alan Dulles, as head of the CIA, had no compunction to call the president or the publisher of the New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, CBS, the Washington Post, and tell them, I want this reporter pulled off that story. I want that reporter fired. I want that reporter moved. I want that story killed. And in a terrible episode of the American press, those executives accepted what he suggested. Great example is in Guatemala. The New York Times sent a correspondent, Sidney Grusin, to report on the land reform program. He started sending back articles saying, this is not something that the Kremlin made up. This is something that's urgently necessary because Guatemalan peasants are starving while there are hundreds of thousands of acres owned by United Fruit that are not being used for anything. After a couple of those stories, Alan Dulles called up one of his contacts at the New York Times, and within a couple of days, the New York Times pulled Sidney Grusin out of Guatemala and sent him to Mexico on some phony pretext. We have many reports of reporters who understood a little bit about what was going on, who either were pulled off the beat or decided on their own out of what one of them later called a sort of patriotism, not to report on these episodes.
Of course, these habits persist. President Kennedy told young Punch Sulzberger, couldn't you please get that guy David Halberstam out of Vietnam? He's driving my generals nuts, which he was. The legend of the New York Times is that James Reston said, we're going to extend David Halberstam a year in New York Times. So maybe things had changed some. But let's talk about the very end of the Eisenhower days and how it spilled over into John Kennedy's administration. First, the Bay of Pigs plan had been hatched in the Dulles CIA. And in fact, Lumumba had been killed by Congolese operatives of the Belgians and the CIA days before John Kennedy took office. So these things are live in his first days in office. He authorizes the Bay of Pigs sort of little dart to start a revolt in Cuba. Of course, it flopped, and he was bitter ever after about the CIA. Lumumba, he said in his early days in office, should be restored to the government of the Congo, not knowing that he was dead by then. It seems to me all of this history reads differently and asks different questions on the 50th anniversary of John Kennedy's death. John Kennedy fired Alan Dulles. He started major cuts in the CIA to be extended over years. You quote that line that appeared in the New York Times that he wanted to splinter the CIA and scatter it to the four winds. He's at war with this intelligence agency. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said this year, he told Charlie Rose said, who killed your uncle? Was it the Cubans? Was it the Mafia? Was it the Russians? And Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said, a rogue CIA. By 1963, the fired Alan Dulles looks to me like the embodiment of rogue CIA. Why should he not today be on a suspect list of the people who killed JFK?
Well, first of all, let's go through the transition from Eisenhower to Kennedy. Only 36 hours after winning the presidential election in 1960, John F. Kennedy held his first press conference in Hyannisport. He wanted to convey an image of action, vigor. His very first sentence in his first press conference as president-elect was announcing that he was retaining Alan Dulles as head of the CIA. That was his first announcement ever in public after being elected.
And J. Edgar Hoover, in the next breath, was reappointed to the FBI, as I remember.
Absolutely. That was the two parts of the first sentence. He said he was reappointing Alan Dulles and J. Edgar Hoover. Now, by this point, the Bay of Pigs project was already well underway. Kennedy had some doubts about it, but new president, inexperienced, young, I think was a little bit in awe of Alan Dulles, with whom he had shared stories about James Bond and so forth. And he was eager to be sure that Alan Dulles had a reasonable plan. And one thing that Dulles told him when the possibility of calling it off emerged was that if the operation were called off, there would be what Alan Dulles called a great disposal problem. What he meant by that was you have over 1,000 Cuban exiles training at camps in Guatemala, and if you call off the operation, they're all going to go home to Miami, and they're going to tell everybody what happened, and the permanent narrative is going to be the United States was about to get rid of Castro, but Kennedy lost his nerve, and there's Castro still there. Kennedy didn't want that to happen, but he insisted on a number of changes in the operation. Now, those changes made it much less likely that the operation would succeed. And then, of course, the operation, before it was launched, was publicized on the front pages of the New York Times and other American newspapers. So the secrecy that everybody had understood was absolutely essential to the plan had been destroyed. Now, 8 days before the operation was launched, the two CIA operatives in charge of it went to their boss, Richard Bissell, the deputy to Alan Dulles, and told him that this plot was certain to end in what they called a terrible disaster. But he refused to listen. He persuaded them to go back to work, and certainly what they predicted is exactly what happened. As you say, Kennedy was furious. "How could I have been so stupid?" he asked Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger. He fired Alan Dulles shortly thereafter. And then, as you say, we have this very odd circumstance that Kennedy fires Alan Dulles as head of the CIA. And 2 years later, Kennedy is assassinated and Lyndon Johnson names Dulles to the Warren Commission. Now, Johnson did this for a very particular reason. Johnson was one of the few people who knew, as he had been vice president, that the CIA had been involved in what he called a murder inc. in the Caribbean. He knew that Alan Dulles had been out trying to assassinate leaders in the Caribbean, among them Fidel Castro. He didn't want the Warren Commission to find this out. He was insistent that the Warren Commission quickly come to the conclusion that it was one crazy guy who killed Kennedy. He was very afraid of the foreign policy implications that might come if anything else were held up as a possibility. So Alan Dulles was sent to the Warren Commission and made a member of it in order to protect the CIA secrets. And he did two things there that allowed him to do that. First of all, he briefed the members of the Warren Commission on how to question the CIA witnesses who came before them. And then he would brief the CIA guys about the questions that they should expect and how to answer them. So he succeeded brilliantly in the operation that Lyndon Johnson conceived for him. He carried out his assignment, which was to make sure that the Warren Commission never understood what the CIA was doing, including trying to assassinate other leaders.
This is what's called cover-up, Steve, and it sounds like the original sin among many, many, many sins in the whole Warren Commission, or the whole public understanding of the Kennedy assassination.
I'm old enough to remember the Warren Commission, and it was very clear to me, even at the time, as a kid, that the Warren Commission had been set up for a particular purpose, and that was to come to a preordained conclusion. Now, that conclusion may or may not have been correct, but there's no doubt that the Warren Commission was made to come up with that conclusion. And the fact that the Warren Commission never investigated so many other leads and possibilities is exactly what has given rise to 50 years of speculation. If the Warren Commission had been truly free and truly informed, we might have known a lot sooner, and this industry that has grown up later might never have had a reason to exist.
Certainly any citizen could make an argument that Alan Dulles is a prime suspect here. Not only he has a motive, he has a history with this kind of, you call it a destabilization machine, particularly with Lumumba in Africa. In the days before President Kennedy was inaugurated, they illustrated all the methods of disguise, you know, layered procedures, several people involved, and as the CIA always says, plausible deniability. They're still saying that. Arrange it so that you know, you weren't there, I didn't see you, you didn't see me. Why is it so difficult even to suggest that Alan Dulles could have had everything to do with the Kennedy assassination?
I don't think it's difficult to suggest that, but my own research in working on this book suggests to me that there's a particular reason why I would take Alan Dulles off the suspect list, and I'm going to tell you what it is. When Alan Dulles was given the assignment by President Eisenhower to organize a plot to overthrow Castro, he immediately did something that he had never done before in his career, and that is turn the entire plot over to his deputy, Richard Bissell. During the weeks and months that followed, Alan Dulles was almost completely absent from the planning of the Bay of Pigs project. He showed up at meetings and didn't say a word. He just let Bissell speak. When Bissell went to brief the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Alan Dulles didn't even show up at the meeting. I think that the Bay of Pigs project was the beginning of Alan Dulles' fade. And by the time Kennedy was assassinated, I wonder if he even had the mental faculties to put together such a complex operation.
That doesn't fit your theory that he was appointed to the Warren Commission to keep the lid on, and did.
You're right. I think he was able to focus enough on the project that he was carrying out at the Warren Commission. That was in 1963 and early 64. Nonetheless, I wonder if he really was still alert enough to have carried this out. I give you another example. After Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger wrote articles on denouncing Alan Dulles, essentially, for his role in the Bay of Pigs, and swearing that Alan Dulles had stood in front of President Kennedy and guaranteed that the operation would succeed, Alan Dulles, then retired, sat down to write a reply. But his sister convinced him not to finish it and not to publish it because, as she said, he was already losing command of his memory and his faculties. So this is just one piece of the puzzle. I wouldn't dare to come down a yes or a no on such a big issue. So many people have thought about it. But my own sense is that Alan Dulles personally was, as Admiral Arleigh Burke said later, not the man he once was.
When Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says rogue CIA could well have killed President Kennedy, what's your reporter's instinct here?
I find it a fascinating possibility. Nonetheless, I've never seen any real evidence of it. So if there is plausible deniability, it's still in effect. Of course, rogue CIA and Alan Dulles are not necessarily the same thing. If Alan Dulles was not involved, there could still be a rogue CIA. I mean, Richard Bissell was involved in this project. We had a number of other figures still very active, many of whom very angry at Kennedy. I guess the pieces are out there, but I still have never seen anything that makes me seriously believe that the CIA could have been involved. So that either means that they weren't or that they cover up things just as well as the CIA has sometimes been able to do.
As you say, the striking thing about the Dulles brothers is the persistence of their ways, their view of the world, their instrumentalities, these quick interventions, these executive wars, never a debate in Congress, much less a declaration of war, this kind of thing. Is there any explaining that? Certainly Kennedy in Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam, Nixon in Vietnam, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, the list goes on. What was this unbreakable habit that the Dulles brothers gave us?
Actually, I think it probably is a habit that goes back before the Dulles brothers. You can see the same instincts towards compulsive activism back in the period when Theodore Roosevelt was president and Henry Cabot Lodge and others were promoting American interventions abroad. The difference with the Dulles brothers is that they emerged in the period of the Cold War, which meant that they could not use the tools that earlier presidents had used. The main tool we had used in the past when we wanted to overthrow a government was you land Marines on the shore and you make clear what you want to do and get it done. But in the Cold War, this wasn't possible because you had another factor in the world, which was the Red Army. You never knew when if you landed Marines in some foreign place, the Soviets would then do the same, and pretty soon you're in a conflict that spirals into World War III. That was why they had to go to a different plan, and the plan was covert action. So they were doing the same kinds of things, but in a different way. And I also think on a larger global scale. You know, the American expansion might be seen in three phases. One would be the continental empire, in which we filled up North America. Then came the offshore empire, in which we extended our control over much of the Western Hemisphere. And then, starting in the 50s with the Dulles brothers, you get the move towards the global empire. So they used, A, different tactics, and had, B, a much wider palette on which to work. The impulses that drove them, this compulsive activism, this sense that the United States knows better what's good for the world than the world itself knows, is not only nothing new with the Dulles brothers, but it didn't die with the Dulles brothers. This has been a persistent influence in the American psyche, that there are certain ways to run countries that are right. Those are the ways that we run our country, and every country in the world should be made to run something like ours. The idea that other countries, other cultures have other ways of doing things that might also be good for them was something that not only the Dulles brothers couldn't understand, but that Americans have a hard time understanding.
Yeah, it's a deep American strain. We know that. Empire from the beginning, the war with Mexico. At the same time, there's a counter thread that you write very well about. At the same time, though, Steve, there's a counter thread embodied in as late as the 1950s by the senator from Ohio, Robert Taft, Mr. Republican, the guy that Eisenhower defeated for the presidential nomination. But Taft's vision of a almost isolationist but sort of continental America is still powerful, and it's been powerful all along. You quote a Taft speech saying that the idea of our destiny to overspread the globe is based on the theory that we know more about what's good for the world than the world itself. It assumes we're always right, that anyone who disagrees with us is wrong. How did that Dulles global mastery doctrine dominate that other piece?
You're absolutely right that although the imperial instinct, or the instinct for what Henry Cabot Lodge calls the large policy, is very powerful in America, there's always been this counter current as well. When Henry Cabot Lodge and Theodore Roosevelt were pushing countries around in the beginning of the 20th century and the end of the 19th, there was also something called the Anti-Imperialist League. It was headquartered in Boston. It had chapters all over America, and it attracted great figures like Samuel Gompers and Andrew Carnegie and Mark Twain and Jane Addams. But it was never able to triumph. In the end, it lost out. The same thing happened in the 50s, and I think it's happened. It happened at various periods since then. We still have these two currents, the large policy idea and the more modest idea. The more modest idea has always lost, but I wonder if we are now starting to see some recognition that the idea of the large policy is not unlimited in its benefit to us and actually can wind up being dangerous.
This brings us to the relevance today, Steve, of this whole Dulles question. In the uncertain fight, still undecided, for the mind and the will of President Obama, I mean, to me, that last weekend in August was something like a turning point. The moment between the I Have a Dream anniversary speech before the Lincoln Memorial and the attack on Syria that never happened. All of it in quick succession. British Parliament voted against a bombardment of Syria. The G20 summit in Petersburg said no way. Putin said no way. The Pope, the Secretary General, the EU, everybody lost the idea, and Obama called it off. Add to that this rush of news about the NSA domestic spying. Add to that the emergence of Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden as maybe great liberators of the American mind and American journalism, American reality. Suddenly, we've discovered that President Obama is in dialogue with the new president of Iran. What's happening to the Dulles way of doing things? Is an era coming to an end, in short?
I've asked myself that same question. I found those two episodes most interesting. So, first of all, the president of the United States announced a military operation. He announced we were going to bomb Syria. But many in Congress were against it, and many in the country were against it, and he called it off. I can't remember any episode like this in my lifetime where the president of the United States announced that he wanted to bomb a country, but the American people were against it. This is something quite remarkable. We've always supported military actions when presidents decide to launch them. Then came the telephone call between President Obama and the president of Iran. This is another supreme violation of a basic Dulles principle. The Dulles brothers believed you should never have dialogue with your enemies. They were strongly against, for example, any summits between American leaders and Soviet leaders. They felt that this would only destroy the paradigm of conflict. It makes the other person seem possibly sane and rational, and then you can no longer portray them as evil and threatening. So these two episodes, the refusal to bomb Syria and the contact with Iran, make me ask this question. Did the Dulles era just end? Now, I'm not sure yet, because it's very possible that we're still reacting to the big punches in the face we took in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're a little bit groggy now, but as soon as we get the smelling salts, we'll be back in the ring and punching again. So it might be just a pendulum swing. But I wonder, perhaps the axis of the pendulum is moving, and as we become more aware of the blowback that these operations have, and as we have growing problems at home that compete for resources with these foreign adventures, are more Americans beginning to doubt the idea that the United States should lash out all over the world and try to project its power to every corner of the globe? I hope so. It's too early to say, but if the Dulles brothers are finally seeing the end of their influence in America, that would be something historic.
Steve Kinzer, thank you so much for this book, The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. It's getting to be a lifetime, Steve, of wonderful reporting. Thank you.
Always great to be with you, Chris.
Stephen Kinzer's double biography of the Dulles brothers is part of an epic series by now of Kinzer takes on all the Shah's men in Iran, on overthrow as a habit in American foreign policy, and on a reset of U.S. alliances that may be evolving in the Middle East. You can find links to those books and our several conversations with Steve Kinzer over the years on our website, radioopensource.org. And of course, these conversations aren't over until listeners, that's you, add your comments on our site, radioopensource.org. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.